part two. Now, we were talking about the problems of the Industrial Revolution. We were saying that it's easy to blame these people for not doing anything to help the victims of this situation, but also we do the same thing. I mean, it's the human condition. When you see the suffering of the world and everything like that, you see these blood diamonds and all these other things, diamond mining in Africa and whatnot, and they're called bloodstones or blood diamonds because of the brutal conditions under which they get it. You see, I mentioned Mountain Dew Mouth at the end of part one. What's that? Even in the United States, we have these desperately poor people, large groups of them, not just minorities and things like that, but in the Appalachians. Large area crossing multiple states on the East Coast. You have these desperately poor white people called, terrible name, poor white, T-R-A-S-H. You know, calling human beings trash. Look at that. And you see they are so poor. They in particular, one problem that's always stood out to me over the decades is this syndrome called Mountain Dew Mouth. Mountain Dew Mouth. For various reasons, partly because access to to clean water is very difficult. They don't trust their well water. It's because of pollution and things like that. But partly just a lack of education and whatnot. They drink a lot of Mountain Dew. I mean, huge amounts of Mountain Dew. Now, sodas are really bad for your teeth and really bad for your calcium absorption. Caffeine prevents calcium absorption. Your bones need calcium, your teeth need it, everything like that. But Mountain Dew especially has an unusually high amount of sugar and caffeine. And it's really, really, when you see some of these people, they almost look like a different species. They have osteoporosis at a fairly young age, because the caffeine has prevented their calcium absorption. You see their teeth all rotted out at a very early age. It's and then also compounding these problems, they don't have access to good dental care. And what access they do have, they can't afford. So you see the very, very difficult situations here in the United States, here in Miami. You'll see the homeless and you'll see these drug addicts and whatnot. But, you know, what are we supposed to do about it? We didn't create the problem. So all these things we need to be aware of. I mean, even the clothes we're wearing, things like that, probably made in China, probably made in conditions similar to the Industrial Revolution. You see in some of these Chinese factories, as you may know, they were having so many suicides, they had to put up suicide nets. You had Americans over here. Every now and then they would find notes hidden in a purse or some Christmas decorations or whatever it is that they bought from overseas saying, please help us. Go to the World Health Organization or something like that and give them this letter, because there was so much abuse and so much suffering with child labor and everything like that going on in these Chinese factories. So these are the types of things we need to see. It's history, but it's also the present and potentially the future. And similar to the original Industrial Revolution, we have it helps the country that's doing it a lot. China has benefited greatly. The individual people working in those factories, not so much. But as a whole, the country has benefited enormously. And the same thing happened in England. It produced so much economic gain, other countries immediately copied it. Other countries in Europe. Like so many other things, it crosses the ocean and gets to America. We get into it. Now, the factories were initially set up in the north and did spread west, but there's virtually no factories in the South. There are virtually no factories there. Why? Because the South is completely preoccupied with the growth of cotton. Cotton, except Virginia, which grew a lot of tobacco as well, but cotton. And the thing is, you have to understand, most people, vast majority of people don't know this. Actually, slavery was on its way out. It was dying completely. Even when our country was founded, a good number of our founding fathers were abolitionists. They did not want slavery. But they had to go along with it to keep the country whole, and pretty much everybody thought it would go away on its own. Well, something happened where it didn't. And I'm going to tell you that right now. Now, this is around 1790, and a young scholar from Yale came to the South. He was there on a teaching job. This is how things were done in the South when you had these plantation owners with, they had the money to hire tutors for their children, and that's what they would do, hire people from graduates of Yale or Harvard who had just graduated to come down, live at the plantation, and teach all their children at one time. That's how it works. So this guy came down from Yale, and his name, this is a test term, write this down. Eli, E-L-I, Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y. Eli Whitney is the test term. For that, you need to write, invented the cotton engine. That's why it's called a cotton gin. It's short for cotton engine. Invented the cotton engine, E-N-G-I-N-E, which had the unintended consequence of expanding slavery. Which had the unintended consequence of expanding slavery. Period. He also popularized the use of interchangeable parts. Period. Now here we see that he had come down, he had a very engineering mindset. When he was a kid, he would constantly take things apart and put them back together, and he was very inventive. And when he came down to the South, he heard them talking about this problem they were having with the cotton. It's very difficult to de-seed the cotton. There's two basic types. Long staple cotton, you can get it in Egypt, and that's fine. But most cotton is short staple, which means it has these small black seeds in it, and it's very difficult to get it out, and then very painful to do it constantly on your arm. It gives you this carpal tunnel syndrome, only much, much, much worse than carpal tunnel. And that's one of the reasons they had slaves. They were having the slaves do it. But it's very time-consuming, it's very slow, and essentially it's not that useful to grow cotton and whatnot, because you've got this problem of needing to de-seed the cotton. Well, Whitney looks at the problem, and he creates an invention that will de-seed the cotton, a machine to de-seed the cotton. And this happens to work really, really well. I mean, like everything I'm telling you, there's a lot of more story we could get into, but essentially it works really, really well. And the cotton gets de-seeded so quickly that now these plantation owners, they plant cotton as far as the eye can see. Now that they found a way to de-seed it quickly, they plant, and if you went up in the South in a hot air balloon, you would see nothing but white in the fields, constantly as far as the eye can see. Who's going to plant these crops? Who's going to tend to these crops? Pick the crops? Everything like that. Well, now, slavery, which was dying out because it just wasn't so useful. Now it is exponentially growing, massively, massively growing. And Eli Whitney, his labor-saving device, turned out to have a very bad effect, which he didn't even profit from. You see, he takes his invention around to show it to people to try and sell it to them, and he needs to show it's not a trick. So he would open it up and show them how it worked and everything like that. And what happened is, instead of buying the product from him at a very high rate, high cost, they would just, now that they've seen what's inside and how it works and everything, they made their own. Basically like bootlegging something instead of buying it. And so Whitney didn't make much money there. He also popularized the use of interchangeable parts. He didn't invent it, but he popularized it. Before, when you had a gun, if something broke, the barrel got warped, what, from the heat to firing it, whatever it is, you basically had to throw the whole gun away. Because if you put a new barrel on it, it's not going to fit properly, it's not going to work. Now, with basically a type of mass production, or let's just say standardized parts, where they can be interchangeable, and now if something breaks on it, the trigger, something gets worn away, what have you, the barrel gets worn away on the inside, you can unscrew the barrel and just put another one on, because they're meant to be interchangeable rather than before, where everything was handmade by a blacksmith. But this is part of why the American Civil War was so deadly. Now you've got these mass-producible guns. It's only a part of why it was so deadly, but still. So another great idea of Whitney's, this one he actually made money on, and really it had a negative effect. And all these lessons of history, all these principles, you know, that you never know how things are going to turn out, applying to your own day-to-day life in so many ways. You see, there's a story mentioned in the movie Charlie Wilson's War. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but Charlie Wilson's War is the true story, this movie, about how the Soviet Union, after it invaded Afghanistan, very stupid move, was not able to fully conquer Afghanistan. And a congressman named Charlie Wilson here in America, he noticed this, and he goes on this big, big task to try and help the Afghans fight the Soviet Union. He enlists the help of this maverick CIA agent, and this agent says to him, okay, I'll help you, but have you heard the story of the Zen master and the 14-year-old boy? Congressman Wilson says, no, I have not. But the agent doesn't get to tell the story. They get interrupted, and the movie goes on. And this is a true story, where they go on helping the Afghans, giving them money and weapons and everything like that. Finally, there's only one weapon that the Russians have, the Soviet Union has, that is effective against the Afghans. That's the helicopters. So we give them Stinger missiles, which can shoot down a plane, they can shoot down a helicopter, whatever it is. And eventually, as is the case in history, in the movie, the Soviet Union decides, you know what, we give up. This is not worth it. We're not going to fight in Afghanistan anymore. And they left. Here, this mighty superpower, the Soviet Union, the Russians and the Soviet Union, they give up with this little nothing country which no one had ever heard of, Afghanistan. And at the end of the movie, they're celebrating in this party and everything like that. And the CIA agent says, you know, I never got to tell you the story of the Zen master and the 14-year-old boy. Congressman Wilson says, you know what? Go ahead. I got plenty of time now. In feudal Japan, 14-year-old boy gets a horse for his birthday. Oh, the whole village is saying this is great. You're only 14 years old, but you've got a horse. This is fantastic. Zen master says, we'll see. Some time goes by. Boy falls off the horse, breaks his leg. He's stuck in bed in pain while all his friends are out playing, having fun. He's still stuck in bed. Village says, oh, this is terrible. You're a young kid. You should be having fun. You shouldn't be stuck here with a broken leg. Zen Master says, we'll see. A little bit of time goes by. The village goes to war. There's a whole war, and all the young boys have to go and fight, except for this boy, because he has a broken leg. He gets to stay home in this nice warm bed with his family, eating, sleeping, everything like that. The whole village is saying, oh, you're so lucky. This is great news. This is terrific. And what do you think the Zen Master says? We'll see. Basically, you never know how things are going to turn out in the end. In fact, is there even an end? Things just keep going and going onward, and we never really know. We never really have an ending neat and tidy. You see, there's this anecdote to explain the Asian long view of things, and basically, two Chinese diplomats are eating lunch by the Eiffel Tower. One says to the other, how do you think the French Revolution turned out? The other says, it's too early to tell. Centuries have passed, and that Chinese diplomat is saying, it's too early to tell. So, we can see this in our own day-to-day lives. I mean, let's say you're driving down the road and you run somebody over, and oh no, this is a terrible thing. But maybe that person would have been the next Adolf Hitler. Okay, well, maybe that's a great thing. But maybe Hitler, you know, there's another theory that if Hitler hadn't existed, there would have been someone even just as bad, except that that person would have been more competent, used the military more accurately, and would have been a bigger threat than Hitler. So here you never know with September 11th, with these hijackers who crashed those planes into the World Trade Center, into the Pentagon. One set of these terrorists weren't going to really make it, except that someone at the airline went out of their way to make sure that this person didn't miss his flight. And then when this person found out how, when the airline worker found out, wow, it's because of him that this terrorist act went through, he had to live with that. He had to live with that. But again, there's no way to know how things are going to turn out in the end. And here, the South, now with Eli Whitney's invention and everything like that, it's able to sell as much cotton as it can produce. And you have two separate ways of doing things in the United States. You had the North, free, industrialized, mechanized. You have the South, small towns, agricultural, rural, and based on slavery. Eventually, there would be a day of reckoning, and that came in 1861 with the start of the American Civil War. American Civil War. Now, let us put a pin in that, and then, so this was the American side of the Industrial Revolution, and we'll get back to Europe to see what kind of reaction it produced. As I told you, this is where it's going to come into those ideologies I mentioned. You have this Industrial Revolution. Now we're right around the 1820s. Okay. There were socially minded people who protested the conditions of the Industrial Revolution, wrote pamphlets, books, gave speeches, denounced capitalism, everything like that. But there was someone who really, really denounced it more than anybody before him. And he was a German and a Jewish person. And his name was Karl Marx. Now, he is a test term. K-A-R-L. Marx. M-A-R-X. M-A-R-X. Karl Marx is the test term. For that, you need to write, open parentheses, 1818 to 1883. Close parentheses. His writings laid the principles of communism, comma. His writings laid the principles of communism, comma. Corrupted in different forms. Corrupted in different forms by later political leaders. Corrupted in different forms by later political leaders within Russia and also around the world. Period. Along with Frederick, which is F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-H. Along with Frederick Engels, E-N-G-E-L-S, E-N-G-E-L-S, comma. Along with Frederick Engels, comma. Co-authored, open parentheses, their most famous work, close parentheses. Quote, the Communist Manifesto, close quote, period. Okay, now, and just so you understand, again, a lot of these things may not seem grammatically correct, but I'm doing them for certain reasons. Either the rules that everyone follows are actually wrong, or whatever it is. In this case, book titles are always supposed to be underlined. So the Communist Manifesto is a book. Why did I put it in quotes instead of underlining it? Because I don't want there to be any confusion, and you underline it, which is what it's supposed to be, and then you think it's a test term, which it is not. Karl Marx is a test term. The Communist Manifesto is just a book they wrote, so I don't want you to underline it. Now, I also mentioned that he was Jewish. Later on when we talk about Hitler, you'll see why I point out that Marx was Jewish. You'll see it's... There's always been this question of why Hitler hated Jewish people so much. Well, the basic answer is, possibly, this is a very credible theory. Hitler hated all minorities, and Hitler hated communism. But since so many of the founders of communism and socialism were Jewish, in his mind, he just mixed those two together, and it was Jewish people were double evil, triple evil. They were not only minorities, they were also the founders of this ideology, which he hated. Now, there's more to it, but it's more possibilities. I mean, Hitler was a very difficult person to understand. That's an understatement, frankly. But this is one credible theory as to why he hated Jewish people so much. Now, Marx, he was a brilliant man, I'll give him that. And he believed that this exploitation could only be ended by abolishing private property. No half measures, completely get rid of the entire system. He believed that private property was inherently corrupting. Makes you have this kind of attitude, this railroad, this factory, whatever, this is mine, and you can't have it. And that leads to me being only concerned with myself, and you know, I need to make more money, I need to pay my workers less, and to make more money, I need to make a poor quality product, so I cut corners and everything like that. So to Marx, this is just inherently corrupting. It's not just the Industrial Revolution, maybe a more severe consequence of capitalism, but he believes that capitalism itself is evil. Now, Marx broke down broke down people into basically two groups. Both of them are test terms, and both of them are terms that educated people should know. First test term, proletariat, proletariat, proletariat. So this is the first, not the first test term, first group that Marx broke people into, proletariat. For that you need to write, in ancient Rome, comma, the lowest class of citizens, period. In ancient Rome, comma, the lowest class of citizens, period. Its members had no property. Its members had no property or assured income. Or assured income. Open parentheses, quote, proles, P-R-O-L-E-S, close quote, is Latin for offspring, offspring, close parentheses, period. In Marxist view of capitalism, now Marxist, remember Marx is a name, M-A-R-X, and then IST on the end. Remember I gave you that test term, dash IST? Marxist, M-A-R-X-I-S-T, view of capitalism. Remember I gave you that term, ism. So in Marxist view of capitalism, comma, the underclass of, open parentheses, industrial, close parentheses, workers who own nothing and must sell their labor to survive, period. That was quite a bit you had to write there, but that's fine. So that's proletariat. Now before we go over that, let's get this other test term, the other group that Marx put people into. Don't worry, I'll spell this. This next test term, bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie, and this is spelled B as in baseball. O-U-R-G-E-O-I-S-I-E. Bourgeoisie. For that you need to write, in Marxist view of capitalism, comma, in Marxist view of capitalism, comma, the ruling class who control the, quote, means of production, close quote, comma, through which it exploits the working class. Through which it exploits the working class. Period. Open parentheses. Otherwise, comma, the petty, P-E-T-T-Y, comma, mediocre middle class. Period. Close parentheses. Mediocre is spelled M-E-D-I-O-C-R-E. So open parentheses otherwise, comma, the petty, comma, mediocre middle class. Period. Close parentheses. So Marx broke these people into two groups. Broke all people, basically, into two groups. First group, proletariat. You see, it goes back to ancient Rome, and again, it was the lowest level. And what Marx is saying is these people, they own nothing. They don't even own their own tools of their trade. basically the only thing they have is their labor, and so they have to sell their labor to survive. Now, the bosses, they only care about the machines. They don't care about the workers. You have the workers being exploited to the nth degree. It was, and since it's unskilled labor, they don't have any real bargaining power. You see, just similarly in ancient Rome, there was a similar dynamic when slaves started to be used. Now they didn't need citizens to do the work, and the citizens became unemployed. They went into drinking, all this kind of stuff. So it's the same dynamic over and over again. Marx is saying the means of production, quote, the quote, means of production should be publicly owned. The factories, the railways, the harbors, anything that can be used to produce, that should belong to the people, to the public as a whole, not to individuals. And here, Marx is really saying something extraordinary, because this ideology which he came up with, communism, it's meant to spread over the entire world. That's what it's meant to be. And he's speaking to people all over the world. He's announcing, what he's saying is addressed to the whole world. He's saying that you people in Germany, in France, in England, in Italy, in the United States, everywhere. You workers have more in common with each other than you do with the people in your own countries who are above you. That was really a remarkable thing to say. Back then, especially, I mean, even today, to an extent, if somebody asks, oh, what are you? You say, well, I'm an American. I'm a British person. I'm an Italian. I'm this. I'm Cuban. I'm whatever. But in fact, and remember, back then it was much, much more so. Very nationalistic and everything like that. But in fact, Marx is saying, no, you need to make common cause with your own people. And your own people are your fellow workers. Those people, when you identify yourself by your country, you're basically a fool. Those wealthy people in your country don't care about you. They don't care if you live or die. And so, Marx's famous saying, one of his saying is, workers of the world unite. Workers of the world unite. And again, this is remarkable, especially for that time period. You've all heard of Rolex, the watch. How did it get its name, get its thing? If the product got its name and also the company got its name, because the inventors, these British people, wanted a name that was easy to pronounce, a name that's easy to pronounce, and one that didn't mean anything in any language. You see, if they chose a name in French, well, the British hate the French, so they're not going to buy it. They chose a name in English. The French hate the British, so they're not going to buy it. If you chose a name in Germany, still there would be problems. In fact, part of the reason these two guys who founded the Rolex company originally named it after themselves, but they changed it, partly because their real names sounded too German. And we're getting closer and closer to World War I, so their names, which sounded German, and Britain was having problems with Germany, basically about to go to war with them, people weren't buying the product. So they made up a word that didn't exist in any language. Rolex is very evocative, because watches at that time needed to be wound. You roll the dial and everything back to charge it up. So we have the workers being exploited, treated like animals. In fact, worse than animals, because if a farmer, if his animal gets sick, farmer needs to take care of it. Farmer's livelihood depends on that animal being well. Factory worker gets sick, factory owner says, get out. I'll find someone else to do the job. So, it's, and this ideology where basically everything will be held in common becomes known as communism. But it's also called Marxism. You'll hear that because, to be fair, and I don't like Marx and I don't like communism, but to be fair, what Marx came up with, his idea of communism, is not practiced by people around the world. You look at these different so-called communist leaders, they're not very communist. They are also oppressive, exploitive in their own way, and therefore, to avoid confusion, since it's not what Marx's ideas originally were, even though Marx called these ideas communism, we refer to Marx's original view as Marxism. Just to be clear, that's one thing, and what they do in China is something else. What they do in Cuba is something else. All these areas, none of them really practiced Marx's original vision. But here's the thing, Marx is saying, rise up. You must rise up in violent and bloody revolution. You have nothing to lose but your chains. The only chance they will get is through killing. But that's okay, because they'll be killing for justice. You see, this is Marx's reasoning here. Once private property and profit are abolished, mankind's corruption will also be abolished, because private property is obviously the source of that, is what he's arguing. And we will have a paradise here on earth. And there will be harmony and unity and justice and equality. And here's the thing, what wouldn't you do to get paradise here on earth? Isn't it worth killing a bunch of people? Because that's what Marx is advocating. He says you can't just ask for what you want, you have to take it through extreme, extreme violence. And yeah, millions and millions of people are going to get killed. But ultimately, you will have a heaven here on earth. And you will have a society which works according to one rule. Write this down. According to Marx, society will work according to one rule. Quote, from each according to his ability, comma, to each according to his needs. Period. Close quote. So according to Marx, society will work according to one rule, quote, from each according to his ability, comma, to each according to his needs. Period. Close quote. There are two test terms there. One is each according to his ability. The other is each according to his needs. Now, what does this statement mean? What's going on with this? Well, let's take an example. You've got a young doctor and you've got a single mother. And the doctor is unmarried and has no kids and he's working at the hospital and he's making maybe $150,000 a year. So $150,000 a year. The single mother is maybe a waitress, and she's making about $40,000 a year. According to Marx, okay, this is each according to their ability, but what it needs to do is go according to their needs. According to Marx, the young doctor, yes, he should still be a doctor, or she should still be a doctor, but he's making $150,000. He doesn't need that. Let him make the $40,000 a year that probably the single mother was making as a waitress. So he'll get according to his need, which is maybe $40,000 a year. The single mother, she has three kids, she has whatever it is. She'll still be a waitress, but she'll be making $150,000 a year. Because it's what she needs for whatever reason. This is what Marx is arguing, and this is not charity either. It's just what's fair. It's just doing the right thing. And so this is what Marx wants things to be. No. In order to do this, it's going to be a bloodbath. It's going to be an absolute mass slaughter. And look at Marx's reasoning here. Look at this way of reasoning. Marx is saying that that wealthy person, that, let's say, that millionaire driving a Bentley, he's not just going to give you his Bentley or give up his Bentley and have it sold off for parts or whatever it is and redistribute his wealth. He's obviously not going to do that. So you have to take it from him by force, his money, his jewels, everything like that. Take it and then redistribute it. But even that, let's say you take his materials and everything by force, he's not just going to say, well, I guess it's gone. That's it. He and all the other wealthy will forever be scheming and plotting to get it back. They're not just going to accept that it's gone and live with nothing after they've earned all of that. So they're going to be scheming and plotting to get it back, and they will never give up. Therefore, Marx is saying, the only way to permanently get rid of the problem is to kill them. Kill all these people in your country who are wealthy, who have anything like that, and basically they're bad people anyway. I mean, if they were such good people, how come they have so much when other people have so little? Kill them, and you know, eventually you'll have a heaven on earth. And that's worth a lot. It is worth a lot. Now, most people are shocked by what Marx is saying. They don't want it. They don't want to go out and commit mass murder, everything like that. And so it doesn't really catch on. Maybe 2% of the population become Marxists. That's what it is. And I wonder if they kind of suspected what the truth was, that actually anybody can't do any job. Marx is saying, oh, you know, we've got this neurosurgeon here, but anybody can do it if we just teach them properly. Basketball, oh, well, anybody can play in the NBA or something like that. It's not the case. It just isn't true. If people could be doing it, they would be doing it. And what happens, though, when you kill all these people, let's say they follow Marx's ideas, they kill all these wealthy, talented people, whatever it is, these doctors, these lawyers, these basketball players. Let's say they kill LeBron James, everything like that. Well, Marx is saying other people will be able to replace them in those jobs. He just assumes, you see, Marx just assumes everybody's equal, everybody can do the same thing. It's only injustice that leads to unfair, inequitable results, things like that. So, Marx is saying, when you kill all these people, somebody else will replace them. Just give them a little training and everything like that. Well, it's a lot harder than that. Now, much we could talk about here. I mean, I do usually when I bring this stuff up, I talk about a lot of biases in the way we speak, the way we perceive things, the language that we use. If you see, when we talk about working class, what does that mean? Working class. I mean, middle class, is it this, is it that? What it is that... With working class, it kind of is offensive to these wealthy people, lawyers, doctors, as if they don't work. They work very, very hard. They make lots and lots of sacrifices. And it's not really fair to imply that they don't work. On the other hand, when you hear this description of labor, skilled and unskilled labor, those divisions are usually there, skilled versus unskilled. I would say there is no such thing as an unskilled job. And if we were there in class, I would say, give me an example of an unskilled job. And I will show you, no, that's not an unskilled job. Anything you're talking about, I know one of you, at least one of you is working at McDonald's, very busy now. And I don't know if that person works the drive-through, but, you know, you see people come up, give the wrong order. Then when they get to the window, they act like it's your mistake and try and make the blame on you. You see these other aspects, like let's say your boss comes in a bad mood, takes it out on you. You didn't do anything. It wasn't your fault, but there's nothing you can do. So how do you deal with that? What about colleagues and coworkers who are screw-ups or who cut corners, and then you're going to have to deal with the consequences of that? How do you deal with that stuff? It takes skill. It takes a lot of skill. Let me think here. I don't think we'll have another test term right now. I don't know if any of you are servers, you know, with that type of thing, but so many, you know, it's a very physically demanding job, constantly bumping into things and this and that. You deal with customers, all kinds of problems with customers. Females tell me that customers get very handsy with them, touching them unnecessarily, things like that, or even sometimes outright groping them, basically sexual assault. You see, working in the kitchen, oh, no customers there, anything like that. Well, the kitchen's hot, extremely hot. You can't use the AC there. It ruins the food. There's all kinds of difficulties, even famous actors and singers and everything like that. You see how they have to constantly watch what they eat, deal with the paparazzi, no privacy, every possible thing. So there are difficulties at every level. And I would say, even though there are definitely unskilled workers, I don't think there are unskilled jobs. So, and Marx is just saying that, oh, you know, these people at the top, you can just replace them. That's fine, but you can't. Basically, Marx had a lot of ideas that really don't work very well, at least so far as we can see. Now, as I said, the communism idea really didn't take root, really didn't take hold. Most people didn't want to commit mass murder. They didn't want to destroy society, upend all of society. Some people did, maybe 2% of the people did. But most, as I say, it's not something that they can get behind. Well, we move forward now in the 1860s. A new voice was heard in Germany. Okay? He is a test term as well. Ferdinand. F-E-R-D-I-N-A-N-D. Ferdinand. LaSalle. L-A-S-S-A-L-L-E. L-A-S-S-A-L-L-E. For that you need to write. Believed in establishing socialism. And socialism should be with a capital S. So believed in establishing socialism through a democratic, comma, constitutional state. Through a democratic, comma, constitutional state. Semicolon. Or period. Whatever you want. Then write, violent revolution was unnecessary. Violent revolution was unnecessary. Period. And then write, considered the founder of democratic socialism. And those two words should be capitalized, democratic socialism. Period. So Ferdinand LaSalle is the test term. For that you need to write, believed in establishing socialism through a democratic constitutional state. Semicolon. Violent revolution was unnecessary. Period. Then continue, considered the founder of democratic socialism, Period. Now, he, like Marx, was Jewish. So again, you see this pattern here. And LaSalle's being Jewish is actually one reason why you'll see his name spelled differently. Maybe if you look it up, you might see it spelled as L-A-S-A-L. Well, which is correct. That was his original spelling of his name, but then later on he changed it so it would sound more revolutionary. He made it sound French. And this is what he is. He's very revolutionary in his thinking, and he was a Marxist. He was one of those people who believed what Marx was advocating, but again, people just weren't buying into it. And by this time, more time has passed, and LaSalle saw that actually Marx had been wrong on two major things. First, Marx had said governments would never allow the people to form unions, but they did. Second, Marx had said governments would never give all their citizens the right to vote, but they did. And LaSalle is thinking, well, if Marx could be wrong on these two very major things, maybe Marx was also wrong about the need for a violent revolution. Maybe there's another way. And so he thought about it, and he came up with this idea. He said to the people of the world, "You are allowed to form unions. Form your unions. The carpenters' union, the bricklayers' union, form all these unions." That's step one. Step two, combine all these separate unions into one giant union, the workers' union. Their strength in numbers, combine all into one giant workers' union. Step three, convert that workers' union into a political party, the workers' party. And step four, vote into power people who believe the way that you believe, meaning socialism, communism. And then step five, once you have enough people in the government who believe like you believe, convert the entire government into a socialist communist government. And then you will have achieved this socialist paradise which Marx has argued for. It won't be overnight like Marx wanted. It'll maybe take 20 years, 30 years, but you will have this perfect paradise of a world without the violent revolution. This turns out to be a fantastically effective method, and socialism spreads all throughout Europe. It works. It works very well. Now, that's why these parties are called either democratic socialist or social democrat. If you go to Europe and everything like that, these parties all have that name because this was the means by which they came to power. Socialism, the phrase was not through the bullet, but through the ballot. The ballot is what you vote with. So not through the bullet, but through the ballot. And essentially, LaSalle doesn't live to see this. He actually falls in love with this woman and challenges her fiancé to a duel and gets killed instantly. Foolishly, too. But shot in the stomach, and then he dies. But his ideas work so well that a few decades after he comes up with them, the Labour Party is basically the most popular party in every country in Europe except for England, where it is the second most powerful popular party. So it worked really, really well. And I keep using these terms, socialism, communism, communism, socialism. What's going on with that? Well, this will be the last term of the lecture here, a fairly long thing you need to write, but this will be the last term. Socialism is a test term. S-O-C-I-A-L-I-S-M, as in mountain. For that, you need to write, in Marxist theory, comma, in Marxist theory, comma, the stage following capitalism, the stage following capitalism, in the transition of a society to communism, period. Continue writing, a political slash economic theory. A political slash economic theory or system in which the means of production, comma, distribution, comma, and exchange are owned by the community collectively, comma, usually through the state, period. Continue writing one last sentence. The economy is mostly planned and controlled by the state, comma. Although it may also be market-driven. Although it may also be market-driven. Open parentheses. At times, comma, very heavily. Close parentheses, period. So, socialism is a test term. For that, you need to write, in Marxist theory, comma, the stage following capitalism in the transition of a society to communism, period. A political slash economic theory or system in which the means of production, distribution, comma, and exchange are owned by the community collectively, comma, usually through the state, period. The economy is mostly planned and controlled by the state, comma, although it may also be market-driven, open parentheses, at times, comma, very heavily. Close parentheses, period. Okay, that was a slog to get through that one. But essentially, some of you may be wondering, what is the difference between communism and socialism? Now, first thing, what very few people know is, initially, there was no difference except in the way in which it was supposed to come to power. Socialism was just a different means of achieving the exact same objective. But the thing is, when they got into power, again, this democratic means actually worked very well. So this actually brought these people into power, whereas Marxist views did not. Marxist ideas did not. So they got into power, and then they put into effect a lot of these ideas, distributing money, distributing property, everything like that. But it didn't work well. It didn't work very well, and they had to moderate it. So although initially it had the same ultimate goal, everything owned collectively, they had to scale that back and take a step back from that and moderate it. And so socialism became a halfway point between capitalism and communism. And in fact, it is like half of both. It's a mix of both. Depending on which country you go to, it'll be closer to Marxism or closer to capitalism, because as I say, here they want to control the means of production. What are the means of production? Factories, railways, harbors, all these kinds of things. Distribution, how the goods are distributed, and exchange, so the markets themselves, they will be owned collectively. But it's not pure collectivism. There are people who become wealthy and stay wealthy under socialism, so everything is not equal. The state controls a lot of it, but also a very substantial amount, is market-driven. Your profits and losses and businesses do what they want to a certain extent. So that's the difference between socialism and communism today. That's what it would be. Okay, this lecture is concluding now, but next lecture, I will say a little bit more about this. Just give a few thoughts on communism and socialism and everything like that, why it doesn't work so well, and then we will talk about why it never took root in the United States. The two reasons why it never took root in the United States, even though it caught on like wildfire in Europe. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.